So indeed, I will be talking about some recent work that we've been doing, mainly with these people. So Laurens van der Staten is a PhD student in our group in Ghent, who did actually most of the hard work involved in getting these results. And then with Tobias Osborne from Hanover, and Frank Verstaten, our supervisor in Ghent. So this is the outline of my talk. I will be starting with a quick motivation, then just a gentle introduction to tensor network states for those of you who would not be familiar with them. Then I will try to describe how we look at and how we try to understand elementary excitations of just basically any microscopic model within this framework of tensor network states. And then with so elementary excitations, then I'm thinking of just single particle excitations, really local disturbations of the ground state, and then how we can understand the scattering if you have two of these excitations, and how this would actually help us to, in the end, that's our long-term goal, to have a systematic way of basically deriving low energy effective theory of just starting from the microscopic Hamiltonian and without perturbation theory or large coupling expansion, just within the approximation of the tensor network framework, how we would like to try to systematically derive low energy theories. So the motivation is this tensor network that I will introduce in a minute. So these are variational states that have proven to be very successful for the description of ground states, of local quantum lattice systems, mostly with a gap, although there is of course also an ansatz by Giffrey for gapless systems, for critical systems. And so the motivation of their success is really the area law of entanglement entropy. I also have a slide about this, in case you would not have heard about this. And so what you can do with tensor networks is really get very good approximations to the ground state of such systems. And so this allows us to extract valuable information, local expectation values if you have symmetry breaking, correlation functions, critical exponents with this MIRA network, for example. Recently also topological information in two dimensions in topological phases, the T and the S matrices. But spectral information is somewhat harder. This is, well, not really encoded in the ground state. Most of these things, like this topological information, these critical exponents, are universal properties of the phase of the system. But if you want to get proper insight into the dynamics, into the spectral structure of a system, we need to come up with something else. Now, of course, with these tensor networks, there are also methods for time evolution, especially in 1D. This works pretty well. But nevertheless, it's a bit counterintuitive, because as soon as you start simulating time evolution, the entanglement entropy will actually start increasing very, very quickly. And so you're really pushing the limits of these tensor networks. And the point is, if you're interested in low energy eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, these should still have this area law. So it's not really satisfactory that we are pushing these boundaries just to extract information. So what happens is, if in an interacting system, if you, for example, perturb it and start evolving, this perturbation didn't only create low energy eigenstates, it also has even very small, but even if it's there, some small overlap with high energy states, these have a drastic effect on the entanglement. So we try to come up with a different approach to get information about spectrum. But let us first just quickly run over the basics. So quantum spin system, I mean, the easiest thing is just qubits on a lattice, can be anything else. Just the easiest to picture. So in general, we could write a quantum state as this linear superposition over this product basis and these coefficients. You can think of either as a highly dimensional vector, and so this is the problem. The exponential increase of the Hilbert space is what makes this problem so difficult. So exact diagonalization doesn't work very well. It doesn't get you very far in terms of system sizes. We'd like to think of this set of coefficients as just a high order tensor. This doesn't, of course, it's just a different interpretation. It doesn't do anything about the complexity. So we would like to come up with some some way to express that this is not just an arbitrary tensor, but that it's actually a low energy state of a local Hamiltonian, that it has some special properties. And so these special properties, that's this area law of entanglement that I was referring to before, which is basically stating that if you just look at a pure quantum state, but an actual low energy state of a gapped local Hamiltonian, and you cut out the region and you look at the reduced density matrix, you compute the entanglement entropy. If you would do this for a generic state, in general, you would find a volume law, meaning the entanglement entropy would scale as a number of sites in this block. But for low energy states of gapped Hamiltonians, instead, what people find is that the entanglement entropy scales slower. It scales only as the area of this region or the boundary. So this was rigorously proven in 1D by Hastings. And there are extensions as well. For example, in 1D CFTs, it can be calculated exactly that it's actually not a constant, but a logarithmic. So there are logarithmic violations are possible, but this is still much better than this generic volume law that you would have for random states in the Hilbert space. So this actually motivates kind of decomposition of this high-rank tensor in terms of lower-rank tensors. And the structure I'm drawing here is a projected entangled pair state by Frank Verstraete and Ignacio Chirac. That's actually not the one that I will be using throughout the rest of this talk, but I will be mentioning it in my conclusion. So I just wanted you to know what this actually is. So I'll mainly be using, exclusively be using matrix product states, which in hindsight is the variational clause that's underlying the density matrix renormalization group. And so, but there are of course other structures as well, as I mentioned, for critical systems. It's actually better to have a structure which does not just directly mimic the lattice structure, but actually has an additional dimension in it, such as an RG scale. So this is the MIRA that Giffrey came up with. But my case will actually be so very conservative, the one-dimensional matrix product state. And I will exclusively be looking at translation invariant Hamiltonians in the thermodynamic limit, where we can actually model the ground state pretty well. It's hard to make rigorous bounds in the thermodynamic limit. It's definitely not a let me not go into it. So certainly local properties of the ground states can be approximated very well using these uniform matrix product states, which are just parameterized by a single tensor A. So that's pretty amazing. You're working in this infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And you just have a single set of coefficients which parameterize your state. And this gives you an extremely good approximation. And you can find, the best A to approximate the ground state using some physically inspired algorithms, such as imaginary time evolution. So that's about the ground states. How do we think about excitations? The way we try to describe single particle excitations is just by assuming that on top of this ground state, so these red tensors are just the same ones that appeared in the best ground state approximation on the previous slide. We will just allow for, on a certain block of region of length L, we will just put new tensors or just one big tensor, and then we will make a momentum superposition, plane wave superposition of this state. This for us serves as a new variational ansatz to describe the elementary excitations in the system. So what we're assuming here is that excitations, or at least single particle excitations, elementary excitations, can be understood as local perturbations of the ground state. So it's slightly more general than just a local operator acting here, because it's really at the level of these tensors. But in the end, that's very closely related. So we're really assuming that we can understand excitations in the ground state as the effect of acting with a local operator and then making a momentum superposition. Now, it turns out in quantum field theory, relativistic field theory, the fact that this is possible in a gapped quantum field theory, it's already actually known for a long time. This was proven by Zimmermann in 1958. And it turns out that several of these interesting results that one can prove in relativistic field theory by using all the symmetries that one has. The most important property that one uses in relativistic field theories is just causality. And if you're looking at quantum lattice systems, there's no strict causality, but there is something which is called Leap-Robinson bounds. It's like some kind of soft version of it. And using this, you can actually take many of these nice theorems of quantum field theory and transform them to also hold for quantum many-body systems. And so that's one example of this, using these standard techniques. So by now, standard techniques that were developed by several people, we were able to actually prove that this approximation is justified in a gapped system. And by justified, what do I mean? If this is your approximation for the excitation, and I'm not specifically thinking about this MPS framework, just acting with the local operator on your ground state, it's not restricted to 1D, just in any dimension. If you have a local Hamiltonian that is gapped, then if you're trying to describe a gapped excitation, and by this what I mean is, if you would think of some energy plot, so where you plot energy versus momentum, and there would be a ground state, so the energy is rescaled to be, so that the ground state has energy zero and it's at momentum zero. And then there are, for example, one or a few just elementary branches in this dispersion relation, or in this energy plot. So these are the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, and then you start having a continuum. So for eigenstates here, this approximation is actually valid in the sense that the error that you make with this kind of approximation decreases exponentially in the size L, so the length of this block. And this rate of exponential convergence is actually governed by the gap in the spectrum at this momentum slice. Not only the ones below it, but also the one above it. So if these two would get very close here, these two eigenvalues, then here you would need a larger block to accurately to describe this eigenstates with the same accuracy. So let me try to give an example of this. So this is for the AKLT model. This is of course well chosen because the MPS, the exact ground state is exactly an MPS. If you use this kind of ansatz, if you just do it on one side, this is well known. This was done a long time ago, well in the 80s, by Arovals and Auerbach and Haldane. So this is really the single mode approximation, and you get these red dots as a result. And now you can systematically increase this size, and you see that here this converges very fast because the gap is very large to the next eigenvalue. So this would be a three-particle continuum that we just estimated from having the single particle. It would be somewhere here. And then here, where actually these elementary magnons are getting closer in energy to the two-magnon band, you see that the convergence starts to slow down. And then, so you also get some variational solutions within this two-particle band, but these are, of course, this approximation is not justified anymore, so... this is, on this plot, what I show is, let me just go back. I just take some slices at different momenta, I think pi of 6, 5, and 4, 0.6 pi, 0.5, 0.4. And I just look at these energies as a function of the length of this block, so all the way to 12 or 13. You see that for pi, this really, so it's on a log scale. Really converges exponentially fast. So this exponential convergence starts to slow down as we get closer to this 0.4 pi, where, if you remember, is about the point where basically the single magnon starts to coincide with two magnon continuum. So there you kind of see that it's probably not really exponential anymore. So this is just basically to justify that, as long as you stay away from this point, this ansatz works really well. So you get amazing accuracies on the excitation energies. And so it's not restricted to these states which have an exact ground state as MPS. So if you do it for just a normal spin one Heisenberg antiferromagnet, where the ground state is not an exact MPS, but you can approximate it very well. You basically get all these, you get all these results. Of course, the only one that's really relevant within this approximation is again the single magnon branch, which at some point will stop to exist or will merge with the two magnon continuum. So you also get all these variational eigenvalues in these multi-particle bands, but well, the meaning of these, they're not really, these are certainly not proper eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, but these green ones are pretty good approximations. And just by, I mean, can implement this all very efficiently, and you can, for example, estimate the Haldane gap up to 12 digits or whatever you want. Okay, that's elementary excitations. You can generalize this. This is not really that important. For example, two systems with symmetry breaking, you could have topologically non-trivial excitations. So kinks, domain walls, and even there it works very well. And because what I maybe didn't stress enough is we're really working in this thermodynamic limit. So we can just create a single domain wall, single topologically non-trivial excitations, which is, for example, not possible if you work on a finite system with periodic boundary conditions. They always come in pairs. So we can easily do this. We just use this ansatz where basically to the left of our excitation, we put one ground state. To the right, we put the tensors of the other ground state. So it's harder to justify this just because, well, just because to describe these states, you have to work in the thermodynamic limit. So you need to use techniques from C-star algebra to rigorously go to these proofs of showing that this is the correct ansatz. But just from the practical point of view, it seems to work very well. Yes?
Can you comment again on the meaning of this state? So you have a branch.
Yes.
Which is separated from the continuum.
Yes.
But then you have branches going to the continuum.
In the case of these spin one Heisenberg models, So all of these other points are indeed in the continuum. Yes.
So
the way to think of these is as really two particle excitations, and so this is what I will be talking about in the second part of my talk: how to properly describe this. So what's happening here is you have this ansatz of just a single localized perturbation that is moving around, and what is happening is with these higher energies, these are like superpositions of two particle excitations, superpositions over the, if you would write down, or if you would think of a two particle excitation as two independent plane waves, and you just fix the total momentum and then you make a superposition of the relative momentum, you would be able to localize them in a finite region. But there would not be proper eigenstates because, of course, you would be making superposition over many relative momenta, and so you would be mixing several energies. And so what the eigenvalues you're seeing here have some kind of washed out energy. So if you know, for example, the exact solutions of the two particle band, you would see that you never get very close to like the minimum because it's always a superposition of a bunch of these guys. Yes?
How do you encode the two vacua? You put colors.
Yes. So with these MPS methods, that's pretty. Certainly in this case, you have symmetry breaking. So with MPS tend to favor. If you have symmetry breaking, for example, MPS tend to favor ground states which explicitly break the symmetry. So you could always think of the symmetric superposition, but these are not. With MPS, you would typically find the ones that have maximal symmetry breaking, because these have lower entanglement. To create these symmetric superpositions, you need to make some kind of GHC superposition, which has a higher entanglement. So you typically create if you just do a variational approximation and an optimization, you find one ground state which breaks the symmetry. And then since you know your Hamiltonian has a certain symmetry, you can just apply the symmetry operator and you find another ground state.
So the blue and the
are indeed, that's one. So, or you do another variational optimization, but indeed the easiest way of to think of them is that it's basically these are the blue ones again, but where here you have a string of symmetry operators acting on it. Yes?
So are you saying that we have two branches
Well, just that this is this is really a low energy excitation of your system, that you have one ground state and then you have some kind of domain wall where you switch to the other ground states. But the point is that on a finite system, if you do this on a finite system, periodic boundary conditions, you always need at least two of them. But here in the thermodynamic limit, you can just have one, and where basically you have one ground state extending to minus infinity and the other one to plus infinity. And so this is also what these different colors are picturing here. So the single particle excitation in this model is of this topological nature with two different ground states at plus and minus infinity. And then if you use the normal ansatz, so with the same ground state to the left and to the right, you will only find these green dots. And in this topological sector, you will find those red dots and then the ones above it. So you really clearly see the elementary excitation is this single particle one. Then you have two particle combinations of these, which are again topologically trivial because it's like two domain walls. So you switch to one ground state to another and back to the first one. And then these red ones are three particle excitations where you have three domain walls, so which are again topologically non-trivial. So that's the interpretation of it. So you could say, for example, so this is just actually a plot that's not very good. It's just to motivate why we want to study two particle scattering. So this is, you could think, well, just with the single particle ansatz, I have all these other I have all these other states here, which are not really good eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. But nevertheless, I could try to, within this variational subspace of localized perturbations, I could try to study spectral functions of the model. But you see, especially here in this two particle band, these points are very, very clearly separated, whereas you would really need a continuum here for the exact eigenstates. So what happens if you study the spectral function within this variational set? Well, the slowest branch is really the elementary excitation. So you get that very well. But then here you should get some kind of soft distribution. And well, this is not what you reproduce. You clearly see the effect of these isolated excitations that your variational ansatz is making there, but which are not proper eigenstates. So this density of states is like the integrated version of the spectral function over the momentum axis. So here, it's all of this is dominated by the single particle branch, which you're describing very well. But then here, where there's like a very weak tail, you see some oscillations which shouldn't really be there. And so this really motivates the search for actually properly describing two particle states in these kind of models. And so we also created an ansatz for this. What is the ansatz? Well, the red ones are again just the ground state, the tensors of the ground state. Then we insert two of these localized perturbations, which we actually, well, these actually are coming from solving our single particle optimization. We put them in some kind of superposition of fixed total momentum. But then we allow for basically an arbitrary wave function in terms of their separation, so an arbitrary, where we assume or impose that the asymptotic in the asymptotic regime, it basically are two independent plane waves, so that this wave function here really is of the form of this particular form, so where the first term would correspond to B1 having momentum K1, B2 having momentum K2, and then a counter term where they actually have scattered, so where there is a scattering phase e to the I phi, and the momenta are interchanged. And then additionally on top of that, because, well, these Bs, we created them as a single particle excitations, so we know that these tensors describe low energy excitations when they are isolated in the background, but when they are coming close to each other, we don't know anymore what the physical meaning of this is. So we try to compensate for this by introducing new variational degrees of freedom, just a single localized perturbation with this total momentum. So this basically introduces new variational parameters that will allow us to describe the interactions between these two excitations. Okay, and so the energy basically of this state is completely fixed by the asymptotics, which is well known in the scattering problem. The energy is just the sum of the energies of the incoming particles, but the real interest is basically in describing, in the end, what the effect of the interaction between these particles will be in this single parameter, the scattering phase, which is present in the asymptotics, but which is actually determined by what happens between the particles when they are close to each other. So this is just an ansatz. We can use a variational strategy using our microscopic Hamiltonian. So we don't assume some kind of effective interaction. We just use our microscopic Hamiltonian. So the Heisenberg, well, for example, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. With these ansatz states, you solve them, and these are, for example, the scattering phases that you can extract for scattering two magnon excitations in the spin one Heisenberg model. So what is this? So the magnon excitations, they have spin one. So if you take two of them, they will couple to conserved total spin. And so you have a spin zero sector, a spin one sector, and a spin two sector. The total spin of these two magnons, and within these sectors. So we did not really use the symmetry. So we just solved the scattering problem with completely general ansatz, allowing for the three different spins of the individual B guys. And then this was kind of a confirmation that what we got out of this was nicely block diagonal or diagonal within the total spin basis. So you just extract the scattering phase, which is the effect of the interaction between these two magnons when they were close to each other. It's well known that it's two magnons which are close to momentum pi, so where the minimum of this dispersion relation was, and which have, well, individual momenta pi plus some relative momentum over two and pi minus some relative momentum over two. And when this relative momentum becomes very small, the scattering phase would actually be linear in the momentum. So you can do a linear fit. And these things are known as the scattering length, these numbers. And they agree very well with other estimates in the literature. I don't know if all of them were actually estimated in the literature. So this one certainly was, but I don't know. So the techniques that were used, so you can, for the spin one Heisenberg model, I actually think only this one was known, that you can easily calculated from finite size DMRT calculations and then some underlying theory of what should happen at the boundaries. Yes?
So this phase that you are
yes.
In the next slide.
Yes.
So this phase
is this.
Right. Is this part? So that depends on n. G of n.
No. Well, g of n takes this asymptotic form when n is very large,
n
is n2 minus n1, and so when they are very far apart, when this n is very large, this is the asymptotic form that it should take.
So if n1 is much larger than n2, so if small n is negative, will you have the same phase, or do you have the opposite, or what would happen? Understand this as you have the particle meet at some point.
Yes. In fact, you only need in this kind of description, you only need basically the half infinite line because they are identical particles. So you use the same, well, this is captured by just having these two Bs. So there's always one, we always just call the first one and one and the second one and two, or at position two. But indeed, if you would have distinguishable particles, you would really need an n which goes from minus infinity to plus. Well, that's a good question. So there's a lot of underlying hard work here, which has mainly been done by Lawrence. So it turns out that if you really try to, so you can actually. So this Hamiltonian, so we just use this ansatz and we apply the microscopic Hamiltonian to it, and you really get an effective Hamiltonian for these degrees of freedom. And you can see that for very large n, so for very well separated, you get some kind of block diagonal structure. This is basically a recurrence equation. And you can find basically the solutions of this recurrence equation. So this is indeed the form of the eigenvectors for very large n. And you would find not only these two solutions. In fact, you would find a whole bunch of solutions depending on the size of these blocks. Most of them, or well, I would say half of them minus one is actually exponentially decaying. Then there are two which have magnitude one, which are this, these two momentum superpositions. And then the other half minus one is exponentially increasing. So these ones are clearly not physical because they would correspond to a state which you cannot normalize, which has a norm, well, where the coefficient is growing as n is increasing. But on these exponentially decaying terms, these you could actually use as a basis to expand this g of n. So that's basically how we solved it. And then in combination with the additional variational degrees of freedom in this C tensor. So there's certainly some hidden complexity in which is not mentioned in this slide. Okay, so what can we do with this now that we have these two particle states? So one thing, so I started to motivate this by looking at the spectral function. So this is now using these two particle states, just a slice of the spectral function. So I was just plotting it completely. So now it's just a slice here where with this just a single particle state, you really see this discrete structure. Now, if you take a slice, you just get a nice smooth behavior as you would expect. And well, we compared this to, there was this paper by Affleck and Steve White where they plotted these quantities. So this matches very well. And so then I'm actually coming to this final part of my talk. Yes, sure.
Can you compare with perturbation theory, for example?
The spectral function directly.
Yeah, or these coefficients per potential.
No, what type of perturbation theory would you have in mind? To, what would you take as the starting state, the free model?
We have these two scattering states.
Yes. Yes. Of course. So they interact when they're close to each other, but this is really encoded in this effective Hamiltonian, which is a very complicated beast because it's really about the coupling between these degrees of freedom in this G and then the degrees of freedom in that C tensor. So it's certainly it's a highly complicated object to work with. So I don't know whether it's suitable for doing analytic type of.
You're saying there's no way to estimate this using a tensor.
But if you just extract it, I don't fully see the argument. If you use this to basically extract this effective interaction, we're just solving it exactly. Why would you want to do perturbation theory?
Well, just to see how better this is.
Okay. No, well, we haven't tried that.
Have you applied this to free theory?
I think to the Ising model to get minus one, this is constant. Well, we already put the minus here, so just getting phase zero. Yes. That was a good, another way to verify the algorithm. Okay. So for the final part, so well, the takeaway message so far is that I've now more or less very quickly presented an approach to basically get first the elementary excitations. I'm writing dispersion relation, but it's not just the energies. You get an approximation for the eigenstate, so you can compute quantities of this eigenstate, for example, its spin, etc. And then an ansatz for describing two of these excitations and how they scatter using the full microscopic Hamiltonian as the one that's generating. So it's really, so the, these interactions between these elementary excitations are really determined by the microscopic Hamiltonian, but of course also governed by this interacting vacuum on top of which these excitations are living. So it's not really just, I mean, this, you cannot see this effective interaction directly from the Hamiltonian. It's really complicated effect of this interacting ground state that is mediating interactions between these perturbations. So now the question is, well, with this information at hand, can we already predict something about the behavior of the system if you apply just perturbations to the parameters, for example, or if you apply a magnetic field to this Heisenberg model, or if we apply a low temperature? So, well, clearly the intuitive picture is if you just have a low energy density above the ground state, then the way to think of this is as a kind of sea of excitations on top of this ground state with a very low density. So just low density of excitations on top of this ground state. And then you could think, well, at low density, the interactions shouldn't be very important. So we could try to use a mean field description. This will probably, hopefully, work in higher dimensions. In 1D, of course, it's not really justified. Particles will always interact as soon as there is an interaction. But what we could actually do is just assuming this low density, then just take the two particles interactions into account and assume that higher particle scattering processes are negligible. And then we can just try to use beta ansatz. So approximate beta ansatz if you would like. So we just, the only thing what is important to realize is that to solve these beta equations, the only thing you basically need is just the dispersion relation of the elementary excitations and their scattering phase. And then you can just consistently solve the beta equations. And if you, for example, do this. Yes, indeed. Okay, so this, yes, that's a good point, a valid point. So the kind of example that we've applied this to is this Heisenberg antiferromagnet with a magnetic field. So it's basically this magnons indeed have spin one, but you're just selecting the ones that are aligned along this magnetic field. These are the only ones which will become relevant because this magnetic field will act as a chemical potential and will lower their energy. So you will get a Bose-Einstein condensation of what? Yes? Yes, so what I'm plotting here is as a function of the magnetic field, basically the magnetization. So the magnetization is really the density of these excitations. And so indeed, so at low energy, they would just be free. So low energy would be here. So they start condensing once the magnetic field reaches the energy of the mass of these magnons. And then at low energy indeed, so it's this blue line is just the mean field approximation, so just assuming that they are fermions. And then the green line is what you get if you, basically the first correction that you can do is take the scattering length of these particles into account. So this was done, I think, by many people. Affleck has written many papers on this. And then basically the red curve is our result. So using this not just the scattering length, but really the full scattering phase and the corrected dispersion relation. So not just the quadratic approximation to the dispersion, but really the full dispersion relation. So this would be the magnetization. Then these black dots are basically DMRG results, just as a kind of confirmation that indeed the prediction we make is okay. And then what you see if you would zoom in at this region, so at this onset of criticality, at where this condensation takes place, is that, well, there you, DMRG would have the typical artifact that it's not working very well, whereas with this kind of approach, you can perfectly describe this onset of criticality. This little inset here is actually, as a function of the magnetization, the Luttinger parameter. And again, the green line is just what you get from using the scattering length. And by using this full theory, we get something that deviates from this. Okay, so these are the kind of predictions that we can make. So the conclusion would be that certainly with matrix product states and for one-dimensional systems, I hope I have presented that we can very accurately get information about low energy excitations, so both single particle, two particle excitations, and that we can use this information to really systematically build kind of low energy theory, an effective field theory for the low energy behavior of these models. So of course there are a lot of interesting questions that remain to be solved, whether we can use this formalism to also describe bound states, to come back to this question of how we dealt with this G of N. Bound states in this picture would correspond to solutions where you don't use these two solutions with magnitude one, so the plane waves. So bound states you would be able to fully describe just using these exponential solutions of this recurrence equation, exponentially decaying. Finite temperature, we have some preliminary results on this, but I didn't include it. Whether basically this picture of low energy excitations, we can actually do some quantitative dynamics with this. And then most importantly, of course, would be to generalize this framework to two-dimensional systems and use PEPS as a framework to build excitations on top of it. Okay. So thank you.
So I do not understand the effective field theory that you get. You start from a lattice Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And what information do you extract?
In this case, we extract the interaction between the particles, but we don't explicitly we already use it via its effect on the scattering phase.
So the scattering phase.
But we are thinking so, and well, maybe I should have elaborated on this. Indeed, in other cases where it's less clear how you, for example, so with this example of this magnetization in the Heisenberg field, it's pretty clear that this is what's going on. The magnetic field is basically just a chemical potential for the magnons. And then you get some kind of interacting boson system. But in general, what we could do is just use this approach and just really compute the matrix elements So this is the kind of thing that we're thinking about right now, and it's not completely worked out yet. Is that you would just say, well, I want to write down some kind of effective Hamiltonian for these excitations. So, well, momentum space or so they would have a dispersion relation. They would have momentum. A bosonic character, probably, although if you would use, for example, these topologically non-trivial excitations, this, for example, in a Z2 symmetry breaking system, this would correspond to fermions. And then you can start wondering, so what terms will there be in the Hamiltonian, either with or without perturbation? So if I apply an extra perturbation, what terms can there be? So maybe there's a pairing term, so maybe there's something here, C of P, Seidegger plus complex conjugate. How would you calculate this? Well, you can just take your Hamiltonian with the perturbation and just sandwich this between our ground state that we have found and then state where we put two particles on this side. Maybe it's zero, maybe it's not. So you can start calculating matrix elements, but of course, to make this identification between the quantities that you make here and parameters that you use here, it's not as simple as this, of course. You have to take into account these eigenstates that we're having, the normalization, the overlap. I mean, if you think about this in real space, they are not automatically orthogonal, for example. If you just put two of these B's in the state, they're not automatically orthogonal to putting these B's somewhere else. So you have to think about how would you take this into account.
But what I'm asking is, what constitutes an effective field theory? Is it giving the epsilon rho and epsilon p, c p, etc.?
That's one way, I guess, to formulate it. Yes.
No, I'm just.
Yes. That's
that.
Yeah, this is the direction we're thinking in.
Take a 1D Hubbard chain at half a D.
Yes.
There is a charge gap, no spin gap.
Mm-hmm.
Can you study charge dynamics, charge excitation by this method?
It's a good question. I haven't tried it myself, but I know that Frank has a student who has been applying certainly the single particle method to the Hubbert model at various filling factors. But I'm not up to date on the latest results there, so I cannot really comment on this. Yes. Yes. Well, yeah, this is what I talked about. Just know that so you can basically show that this ansatz will get exponentially better in the size of this block. And so it's certainly, yeah, you certainly have to test whether you're sufficiently close to convergence already or not. So, indeed.
Yeah, when you have this momentum basis, you directly compute the average Hamiltonian using this basis, which you have to compute a lot of overlap. Or you write this momentum state.
Yes.
That's
yes, yeah, sure.
Whether
you can explicitly, yes, sir, indeed. No. We really explicitly, analytically calculate formulas for this effective Hamiltonian as a function of the momentum. And it's certainly, you have to be careful, because indeed, so it's really in the thermodynamic limit. So there are a lot of diverging sums that you have to carefully see. For example, you have to certainly put the ground state energy, and in the approximate case, that's the approximate ground state energy of your MPS. You have to subtract this in the correct way from these diverging sums. But in the end, you end up really with an analytic expression for this effective Hamiltonian that you then can, implement within the same efficiency as standard DMRG calculation. So you don't really want to compute this full matrix, because that, well, then you would have a matrix which is the size of the parameters, well, squared, because it's a matrix. So you want to implement all of this in an efficient way that you can really scale this up to large bond dimensions.
But in general, the shape of this particle may depend on K. You include this K.
Yes. Yes. And that's another one of, for example, the complications, especially if you would like to formulate this in real space. You cannot think of these excitations. So even if you had Fourier transform back, there wouldn't just be one tensor that's localized. Just because there is this P dependence.
So if you fix K, you can minimize energy.
Indeed.
And I see. But to get other states, then
we just find for this effective Hamiltonian, you just look for, for higher, yes. So it's really, because this ansatz is really linear in the B's. The A's are fixed, so it's really a linear subspace. And the interpretation of it is actually, didn't say anything about this, is that you have this MPS manifold. The ground state at some point on this manifold, and now these excitations are, especially for momentum, well, if you think just about translation invariant states, then you really have this tangent space to this manifold, and this is basically your ansatz space. So it's a linear subspace of your Hilbert space that you use as an ansatz for excitations. Yes. Yes. No, not using this. This was just in the general motivation. But I would actually one remark that I can make. So using this continuous matrix product state, so there is a version of continuous of matrix product state for quantum field theories, in the first place non-relativistic ones. And there we tried a similar ansatz, well, basically the same inspiration, but just formulated in the continuum. And we applied it to the Liebliger model, which is actually critical. And nevertheless, we still get very, very good results. Maybe not 12 digits like in the Heisenberg model, but the results we get are still, I don't know, 10 to the minus 5 in difference to beta ansatz results for really bond dimensions of the order of 30, 40. So even there, it works pretty well, actually.
Looks at tensor network states. They're also constructed to bring out nature of quantum fluctuations in the ground state.
Yes.
Entanglement and so on. Now, does it mean that by looking at the ground state wave function, looking at the matrix carefully, you may be able to make some statement about the spectrum, nature of excited spectrum, without doing the exclusive calculation that you are doing, constructing an excited state? That is, just look at the ground state.
And the transfer matrix, basically, so the what you can extract from the correlation functions, or
just by looking at the matrices that constitute the tensor network, can you infer something about the spectra?
So the tensors of your ground state.
Yeah.
Well.
See, why I'm saying this, for example, suppose you have a harmonic chain.
Yes.
The ground state is supposed to be a product of Gaussian.
Mm-hmm.
All oscillators in the ground state. So by looking at it, one can say that excitations will be of this type.
But that's a completely local description then, or so there is actually something like, it's not exactly like that, but one direction that we've been thinking, or basically something that we've observed in the numerical experiments is, and it's certainly not a surprise, so it's more or less what you would expect, but nevertheless, it's useful in practice. So if you just think about the ground state and you think about correlation functions in the matrix product state, for example, but the nice thing is that since it's for ground states, this easily generalizes to PEPs, where I mean, these excitation methods have not yet been developed for PEPs, but ground states certainly have. So if there is some kind of correlation function between an operator here and then some operator here. So this correlation function is determined basically by this object. The scaling as a function of the distance. And so this is what is called the transfer matrix of the matrix product state. If you look at these eigenvalues, of that object, they should all, just for normalization reasons, the largest eigenvalue should be one. So if you plot them in the complex plane, in general, this matrix, it doesn't have to be Hermitian or anything, so you can get complex eigenvalues. The largest one should be one. And then if you look at something like this for a system with a close to criticality, for example, in this Hubbert model studies of Valentin Sauner, a PhD student of Frank in Vienna, what you find is that almost all of the eigenvalues of this object, they cluster basically on lines. And then there are some basically here in the middle, very small ones. So it's definitely the ones which are closest to the unit circle, and these are the ones that basically dominate the correlation function, they cluster on lines. The way to think about this is, or at least the way I understand this is if you look at, if you assume that indeed the low energy description of these critical models has a relativistic nature, then for these type of spatial correlation functions, there should be some, in a relativistic description, you could use the Kalman-Lehmann representation of the correlation function, which would basically contain something like the dispersion relate, or is it, no, it's like this. Well, in general, I mean, if you, talking about relativistics, it's like this. So that would be really in the continuum, but you can try to think about, it's just a matter of mapping this to a continuum. If you're mapping this to a continuum, it's like taking the logarithm. So what I'm saying here is if you would plot, if you would think of the angular variable here as a kind of momentum, so I would plot the phase of the eigenvalues here, and then I take minus the logarithm of the absolute value of these eigenvalues, and I plot them in the vertical direction, then you would get these kind of vertical lines. And this corresponds to what happens in the Kalman-Lehmann representation, the spatial correlation function as this kind of representation, meaning that there is this integral here over the real line in P space, but which actually has branch cuts, for example, at IM and minus IM. And so, of course, in this relativistic model, all the minima of the dispersion relations are at momentum zero. But now suppose that after blocking, for example, or just by unblocking, some of the dispersion relations have minima at other values, you would probably just find more branch cuts here. So you could basically fold this integral that you're taking here, you could try to fold it along these branch cuts. And what these eigenvalues of this transfer matrix seem to be doing, because if you look at the expression I erased for correlation function in MPS type language, in this MPS, they would basically be approximating these correlation functions as a sum of exponentials, where these lambdas are exactly the eigenvalues. So what these eigenvalues are doing are basically mimicking these branch cuts that you see in the Kalman-Lehmann representation. And so this is how. So there is certainly some hidden information about, not maybe the full dispersion relation, but about especially where the minima of the dispersion relation are in the ground state. But I mean, and there are different ways to motivate this. If you want to work in the other direction, if you know that this is the correlation function and you would use single mode approximation, then it's very clear that since the correlation function is in the denominator, that you would get very low energies if you get resonances in your momentum correlation
this
function.
This just gives you a modulation in your correlation, right?
Yes, sure. It's indeed. So these phases correspond to modulations in the exponential decay, and so you would get if you look at correlation function in momentum space, you would get resonances. So if you would use single mode approximation, these would appear in the denominator. So you would get very very low energies within the picture of the single mode approximation. So that's another way to think about this. But especially this, I mean, the fact that you get these branch cuts, or that you seem to reproduce these kind of branch cut structures, is very intriguing.